In 2001, five Cubans in Miami were found guilty of conspiracy to commit espionage and other charges. Only one of the five, Rene Gonzalez, has been released. He returned to Cuba earlier this year. The other four, Geraldo Hernandez, Antonio Guerrero, Ramon Lambanino, and Fernando Gonzalez, remain in jail in the United States. What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five, is a new book on the activities, arrests, and trial of the five Cuban intelligence agents. The book's author, Stephen Kimber, is a professor of journalism at the University of King's College in Halifax, and he joins me now by phone. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
I want to start by talking about the trial of the Cuban Five and what they were found guilty of. Can you explain the accusations against the five relating to the Brothers to the Rescue planes that were shot down by the Cuban government in 1996?
Well, there were sort of, I think you'd say, three sets of charges. There were the minor charges. They were charged with failing to register as foreign agents, which normally if you're a foreign agent you wouldn't be expected to do. And some of them used false identities in the United States. So those were relatively minor charges. Then there was a charge called conspiracy to commit espionage, which was not to say that they committed espionage, but that somehow they conspired and possibly might have, if the opportunity arose, committed espionage. The conspiracy is a really complicated charge because it makes it easy for people to be convicted without evidence that they actually did anything. And the third charge, which is the one that relates to the Brothers to the Rescue, and was against one of the five, was conspiracy to commit murder. And what happened was that in 1996, the Cuban government shot down two planes belonging to an exile group called Brothers to the Rescue from Miami. That exile group had been, in the year preceding that, going into Cuban airspace illegally. They dropped pamphlets on Havana. They had gone home and bragged about what they were doing. The Cuban intelligence also knew that they were test-firing weapons from those planes in the Everglades, Florida, and therefore those planes could have been used to attack Cuba. They warned the United States on a number of occasions that they might shoot them down, and then they did. So that's a fact situation. Whether you agree with what they did or not is entirely up to you. But the second part of that is, Gerardo Hernandez was charged with conspiracy to commit murder because the prosecution charged he knew about and was involved in the decision to shoot down those planes. Now, what I did in terms of research was I read the transcripts of the trial and the evidence that was presented at the trial, and there is no real evidence to support any of that. He was a low-level, street-level, illegal intelligence agent, controller of a small group of other intelligence agents. The Cuban state security was definitely on a need-to-know basis. If you didn't need to know, you weren't going to be told. So he wouldn't have been told about this operation. He might have inadvertently been communicated with about the operation, and that's part of what the prosecution was claiming to a certain extent, although they were claiming that he knew about this. But in fact, all of the evidence that they presented was really ambiguous. There's no, there was a judge in Atlanta in one of the appeals who said basically the Cuban government had sent a message to Hernandez about the plan to what they called perfect the confrontation with Brothers to the Rescue. What did that mean? Prosecution claimed it meant shoot them down. A judge said, it could have meant that. It could have also meant they were going to force the planes down and arrest these guys. It could have meant they were going to buzz them. You know, all sorts of possibilities. But because this trial happened in Miami, Miami is this hotbed of anti-Cuban exile or anti-Cuban government, anti-Castro groups, that it was very hard for them to get a fair trial. And I think if you look at the evidence and compare the evidence with the verdict, you'll see that that's what happened. They did not get a fair trial.
And was the fact that the five men were communists and Cuban communists living mm-hmm. in Miami used against them at the trial?
Oh, absolutely. Not only in the trial, but in the lead-up to the trial. some of your listeners may remember that in 1999, which is after they'd been arrested and before they actually went on trial, there was a young boy named Elian Gonzalez who was rescued from the waters off Florida, whose mother had tried to bring him on a raft to Florida from Cuba. She had died. This boy's family in Miami got into a tug of war, a custody battle that became an international cause célèbre with the Cuban government and with their own government, who said he should be returned to his father. But so what you had was a situation where, you know, the pot was stirred against anybody who was connected with the Cuban government, as these five guys were. Clearly, they were Cuban intelligence agents, and that was something that was known. In Miami, you had this sort of natural bias against the Cubans, but you also had it being stirred up by local journalists who were writing the most incendiary things about these Cuban intelligence agents. And it wasn't known at the time. It was only known in 2006, and now we're learning more and more details about this, but that a number of these journalists who wrote these incendiary pieces, both in English language, but especially in the Spanish language press in Florida, were in the pay of the government. So they, one can argue that they probably would have been anti-Castro, anti-Cuban to start with, but they were also being paid at the same time that the government was putting these guys on trial. So it was a double whammy, if you like.
Your book describes the individuals and organizations that the Cuban Five were spying on, not the U.S. government, but people mostly in Miami who have been connected to terrorist activities against Cuba, including hotel bombings and assassination attempts. And your book also describes the evidence that the U.S. government was aware of these activities. Can you talk about how this violates international or domestic law?
Well, certainly in the case of United States law, there is an act called the American Neutrality Act. It dates back to the 1930s, I believe, 1920s, 30s. And essentially what it says is you cannot plan an attack on a third country from American soil. So they were these exile groups that were plotting attacks, and as you said, they included hotel bombings. Eventually it came even to include an attempt to blow up an airplane filled with tourists coming to Cuba. Those plots were being planned in the United States. The Cubans were aware of them, and so in many cases were the American law enforcement officials. They tended to look the other way when it came to violence against Cuba, terrorist attacks against Cuba. And this, sort of looking back, and we think about what George Bush said after 9/11 about, anyone who harbors a terrorist is a terrorist, terrorist states, all that sort of stuff. When in fact, if you flip it and really look at it, the American government was harboring a number of high-profile accused terrorists in Miami, people who had been accused of actually blowing up an airplane back in 1976, a Cubana Airlines Flight 455, that killed 73 people. So they were, this in fact was something that was well known to the American authorities. Part of it, there was CIA connections, all of that sort of stuff. Said that this allowing people to plot terrorist attacks from your country to another country is a violation of both national law and international law. Now, one of the things that was really interesting about what happened in the case of the Cuban Five, I mentioned that they had discovered this plot. Cuban intelligence agents had discovered a plot to blow up an airplane filled with tourists, and it could have been coming from Europe or Canada or Latin America. And they knew enough about the plot to know who was behind it and that mercenaries were going to be involved. But the Cubans also knew that they couldn't stop it by themselves. So in June of 1998, Fidel Castro employed the assistance of his good friend, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, to take a message to Garcia Marquez's other good friend, Bill Clinton, about this plot. Now, what happened after that was that Clinton instructed the FBI to look into it. The FBI and Cuban state security got together. This is unprecedented. The FBI sent a delegation to Havana in June of 1998 to sit down with their counterparts in Cuban intelligence. The Cuban intelligence people handed them documents, transcripts of wiretapped conversations, bomb fragments, a lot of pieces of evidence. Not enough that would have gotten a conviction in an American courtroom, but enough to justify further investigation. The FBI agents who were there in Cuba said, yes, you know, we take this very seriously. We want to go back to the United States and investigate, and we'll get back to you. And instead of that, this was June 1998, 3 months later, instead of arresting the terrorists who were plotting these attacks, the FBI swept in and arrested these five agents who were, in fact, trying to uncover these terrorist acts.
I wanted to talk a little more about the situation in Miami, and your book references a 1994 Human Rights Watch report on threats to freedom of expression in Miami. What have been the threats to people in the Cuban community who may be more sympathetic to Castro and communism, or possibly just not as anti-Castro as some of the leaders in the community?
Well, if you go back to the 1970s, the FBI called Miami the terrorist capital of the United States, and it was in part because the exiles were fighting, in a certain sense, among themselves. And you had exile groups plotting attacks, including assassinations, against other exiles who weren't pure enough, who weren't anti-Castro enough. So that was going on from the 1970s on, and there were... During the 1990s, the Human Rights Watch came to Miami because they were concerned about freedom of expression, that the intimidation level was such that people could not speak out. And they did one report in 1992 that essentially made that point. And then 2 years later, they came back to see if anything had improved. And in fact, it had gotten worse in some ways. And one of the examples that they used was there was a group of moderate Cuban exiles living in Miami who took a trip back to Havana in the spring of 1994. When they returned to Florida, they were shunned. They got death threats. Some of them were physically attacked on the streets. Their businesses were boycotted. And for what? For simply going to Havana and attending a conference. And that was the extent of what these people had done, and yet the exile community, you know, had sort of threatened them with reprisals. And what was really funny to me was, not funny, but funny in a sad kind of way, was when Human Rights Watch announced that it was going to release the results of this latest report, they booked a room in a restaurant in Miami, and they had to hire nine Miami policemen to protect them when they released their report on freedom of expression. So, you know, you get a sense of just how bizarre and dangerous a city Miami was.
We are now getting further away from the time of the Cuban Revolution, and more of the people who are coming to Miami now from Cuba would be coming for economic reasons, mm-hmm. I imagine, rather than as anti-Castro political exiles. Do you think the political climate is changing in Miami and becoming more tolerant?
At some level, yes. It was interesting. In promoting this book, I was invited to appear on an NPR station in Miami, and then at the last minute that invitation was canceled because they thought the topic of my book was too incendiary and that it would upset people in the community. They changed their mind and they did interview me, although they did it as a kind of a confrontation instead of an interview. But afterwards I talked to one of the interviewers, so this was off mic, and we were just discussing the situation. He said, you know, he came to Miami in 1999, and yes, it was terrible then, but everything was fine now, and I didn't really quite understand what I was saying. But in fact, all I had to do was point out a number of incidents that have happened in the last couple of years. So if you're a baseball fan, You know that Jose Guillen, who was the manager of the Miami Major League Baseball team, was suspended for a week for saying that perhaps Castro wasn't such a bad guy. And he had to be suspended because the community was in such an uproar. There was a case that happened. There was a group that put up a poster, a billboard, on the top of a building in Miami to free the five, you know, one of those groups in support of the freedom of the five. There was a restaurant in the ground floor of that building. It had nothing to do with the billboard whatsoever. And their business was threatened merely because they were there. And then, you know, the third example of more recent hostility toward Havana or toward Cuba was in, I think it was 2009, 2010, whenever it was that the last Pope visit to Cuba happened, there were a number of Cuban exiles who clearly wanted to go and see the Pope, and there was a charter company in Miami that flew them there. That charter company was firebombed afterwards. So there's certainly a difference among many people in the exile community. It's not fair to think of it as a monolith, but the power in that community is still very much skewed to a kind of the old-style anti-Castro, anti-Cuba viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I've been speaking to author Stephen Kimber, and his book, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five, is published by Fernwood. And there's more information on the book at fernwoodpublishing.ca. And you're listening to Mud and Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.